You're listening to Highlights of the Creative Process and One Planet podcast interview with two-time Pulitzer-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
So I think that growing up in a tiny town very much affected my journalism and how I see the world. It has always felt to me that Washington and the national media establishment, for that matter, kind of neglect small towns like mine and people like those around me and the issues that concern us. I mean, right now, one is addiction. We've got more than 100,000 people a year dying from overdoses, including many of my old friends. And I don't think that America has come to terms with that adequately. And so I think the same is true when we go to other countries, that when we in journalism try to cover what is happening in some other country, we go to the capital, we talk to officials, we typically talk to university-educated men who speak English over 50, and that's a pretty tiny slice. And so I think that has encouraged me to go leave the capital, talk to other people, try to engage and understand what is happening more broadly. I was the Beijing bureau chief of the New York Times and had covered the Tiananmen democracy movement. It had seemed so full of hope, and it seemed as if maybe democracy was going to come to China and greater freedom, and there was a leadership fight and unclear who was going to win. And that terrible night of June 3rd to 4th, 1989, I heard that the troops were busting through student lines and headed toward Tiananmen. I rode my bike out. I got to Tiananmen Square a little bit before the troops did, and then they arrived and opened fire on the crowd that I was in. And I was terrified, but to watch a modern army turn weapons of war on unarmed protesters, you don't forget that. That changes you. And I guess I also think of it in a larger context, and maybe especially as democracy has become an issue here in the U.S. in recent years. And frankly, I was a little bit disdainful maybe of some of the less educated protesters at Tiananmen, the peasants from the countryside, the workers. And I wrote periodically that, oh, they say they're for democracy, but they can't define the kind of democracy they're in favor of. They can't talk about the institutions they want, the guardrails. And that was all true. But that night, it was those uneducated workers and peasants who were driving their rickshaws out whenever there was a pause in the firing to pick up bodies of kids who'd been killed or injured, who blocked the troops. You know, one bus driver, salt-of-the-earth bus driver, he saw the convoy of troops coming in trucks, and he parked his bus across the road to keep the trucks away and turned off the engine. And then when the officer pointed his firearm at him and demanded he move the bus, this bus driver just hurled the keys into the grassy verge, into the high grass. People like that might not have been able to define democracy, but they were willing to risk their lives for it. And I do think that they have an appreciation for the virtues of democracy that we in the U.S. sometimes don't. We take it for granted. And I think there's a lot we in this country can learn from the courage and commitment of people like that whom I witnessed in June 1989. In writing Chasing Hope, I kind of self-diagnosed myself with maybe a mild case of PTSD, which just shows how hard it is to manage these issues. I do think, and I'm not proud of it, that over the years and decades, I developed a certain emotional armor. And it's probably a little parallel to an emergency room physician who is surrounded by trauma victims, but you just have to create some distance from that pain just to get through the day. And I think I do have some of that armor, and I can sleep at night after seeing a massacre. But where my armor breaks down is in particular where children are involved, or where somebody that I am close to, maybe my interpreter or something like that, has been in jeopardy, or I fear that I put somebody at risk. And that haunts me. Every now and then, sort of unexpectedly, you'll interview somebody and, you know, I just find myself completely tearing up, and it has somehow penetrated my armor and it gets to you. The business model for journalism is kind of collapsing. And traditionally, newspapers were often monopolies or oligopolies. And so they were making money. And so they were perfectly fine being committed to covering important things that readers weren't terribly interested in. And that business model has already collapsed for local journalism around the country. We're losing an average of 2.5 newspapers each week around the country. We've lost more newspaper journalists than we have coal miners over the last decade. And in terms of national, international coverage, then look, the New York Times still has a good business model. The Washington Post has a business model in the sense of Jeff Bezos has a large checkbook. The Wall Street Journal is doing okay, but the news weeklies are collapsing. The television is struggling. So if you think about the world right now, there are still reporters covering the war in Ukraine. There are still folks covering the war in Gaza. But you don't have reporters covering what's probably the world's biggest humanitarian crisis right now, the famine in Sudan, you know, with some exceptions, of course. But it isn't getting much coverage. Yemen wasn't getting much coverage when it was the biggest crisis. And I think that's fundamentally because it's expensive and dangerous to cover those kinds of international stories. And there's not much of an audience for it. Once I did back-to-back columns about the Yemen humanitarian crisis and Brett Kavanaugh when he was nominated for the Supreme Court. And the Kavanaugh piece I could whip off in a few hours. The Yemen piece resulted from an expensive, somewhat dangerous trip to Yemen. And it wasn't just that the Kavanaugh piece got 50% more page views or double the number. It got 7 times as many page views. And so you can understand why an executive producer doesn't want to send a camera crew to Yemen when they can put a Democrat and a Republican in a studio together and have them yell at each other.
Your writing has inspired notably Bill and Melinda Gates to focus their philanthropy on global health. And the former head of the International Rescue Committee said your coverage of the genocide in Darfur saved hundreds of thousands of lives. So considering the changing face of journalism, how can we continue to be catalysts for positive change, considering all these issues that you have mentioned?
Well, boy, I hope that we come up with a solid business model for journalism. And one may emerge. The New York Times really has managed to put one together. And that's why it's covering these things. I'm actually planning a trip to Sudan right now, and it will probably lose money for the Times, but the Times is willing to send me to cover pieces that maybe only my mother and wife will read. But we need a better business model for journalism as a whole. I think that there may be ways for journalists to partner with aid groups around the world to help cover crises. And it may be that think tanks also, who already do some reporting on these kinds of issues, that think tanks will also manage to cover some of these issues.
Indeed. It makes me think about you were going to run for governor in Oregon, maybe thinking about how you could apply these skills and make those changes. I think you would have been a great candidate.
Yeah, I was tossed off the ballot by the Secretary of State. And so my wife says that this side of Kim Jong-un in North Korea, I'm the only person to have had an entire political career and never had a single person cast a ballot against him, which is a nice way of phrasing it. But, you know, that arose from seeing a lot of pain that has been unaddressed. And it's kind of rooted in my own community that in this farming community here, about a third of the kids on my old school bus are now dead from drugs, alcohol, and suicide. And it's just been heartbreaking to watch. And in many cases, they suffered greatly, but they also inflicted great suffering on others. You know, hurt people hurt others. And when it's a low education area, when people lost jobs in the sawmill or in the factory, then they weren't prepared for a 21st century economy. And then they self-medicated with meth. The family structure collapsed. And it's been really painful to watch. I don't think the political system has adequately addressed these issues. And the urban-rural divide is enormous in Oregon as well as all around the country. So that was what impelled me to make that leap. But it was not to be. So now I, you know, chase windmills using my journalistic tools, not political ones.
Yes. And it was just a question of that you weren't resident in the state all the time. So we should put that detail out there.
It wasn't for my criminal record. Yeah. Our view was that the Secretary of State pushed me out because I was leading in the polls and leading in fundraising. Now, she would have a different view, but she pushed me out based on an argument about residency. If you look over the last 500 years or so, the best metric to predict where a society will be in 30 or 50 years, the best metric is simply education today. And the one reason I think the U.S. is the world's largest and most successful economy today is because beginning in the 19th century and through about 1970, the U.S. led the world in mass education. And what matters is not so much elite education. Britain had Eton, it had Oxford and Cambridge, it had better elite education, but it wasn't great at mass education. And the U.S. really was. We were the first country to have almost universal literacy, male and female. We were the first country to have widespread high school attendance, then the first country to have significant college attendance. And then beginning in about the 1970s, we lost that lead. And now there are many countries that are way ahead of us. And I think back to my old classmates who are now dead. And I think, what were adults thinking in the 1970s that they let them drop out? And yet I think today, what are adults thinking in 2024 when they let 1 in 7 American kids today drop out of high school and let so many emerge from the school system not literate, not numerate, completely unprepared for the 21st century? And this is one of those issues that isn't particularly partisan. Probably the best states in the country in terms of K through 12 education are Democratic ones with strong teacher unions, Massachusetts and New Jersey. But the state that has probably had the biggest gains in K through 12 education over the last 15 years is Mississippi, a red state with weak teacher unions. And there are lessons to be learned across the board. But in America, we're very good at investing in the human capital of our own children and very poor at investing in the human capital of children as a whole. There have been some alarming experiments that show that AI arguments are better at persuading people than humans are at persuading people. And I think that's partly because we humans tend to make to others the arguments that we ourselves find most persuasive. And so a liberal will make the arguments that will appeal to liberals, but the person you're probably trying to persuade is somebody at the center. And I think we're not good at putting ourselves in other people's shoes. That's something I try very hard to do in the column, but I often fall short. I think that people are going to become more vulnerable to this, to being manipulated. I think we're also at risk of being manipulated by our own cognitive biases and the tendency to reach out for information sources that will confirm our prejudices. Years ago, the theorist Nicholas Negroponte wrote that the internet was going to bring a product that he called the Daily Me, which was going to be basically information that was, you know, perfectly targeted to our own brains. And that's kind of what we've gotten now. And a conservative will get conservative sources that show how awful Democrats are and will have information that buttresses that point of view. And liberals will get the liberal version of that. And I think we have to, all of us, try to understand those cognitive biases, understand the degree to which we are all vulnerable to being fooled by our brains, by selection bias. We tend to understate the problem of sweatshops because it's not only that workers are not paid very much, but it's also that they often, depending on the economic sector, they often pollute local waterways, for example, and cause other problems. At the end of the day, the one thing in a very poor country, even worse than being exploited in a sweatshop, is to have no job at all, or to work on a farm in a rice paddy, earning no money, having no future. And we have seen in Asia in particular that sweatshops were a path to raise living standards. And I remember in Indonesia talking to a mom with her young son who were scavengers in a garbage dump, which is one of the worst jobs one can have. And I asked her what she hoped for her young son. And her dream for him was that he would grow up and work in a sweatshop. And that stuck with me. And it's very easy for Americans to denounce sweatshops, and their rationales are pretty good. I mean, they're real problems, and some of them can be corrected, like fire exits being blocked. That should not be tolerated. Sexual harassment of workers is likewise a problem. But you just demand that, you know, Nike pay more to workers, then the upshot is that the companies are not going to source production in the poorest countries. They're going to go to somewhat richer countries. They're going to go to Malaysia rather than Madagascar or Ethiopia. And indeed, already the really poorest countries, they haven't been able to participate in that manufacturing boom because a company could only do that profitably if it paid so little that people would jump on them as exploiters. And so this hasn't managed to help the poorest countries and the poorest people in the world. I think that one of the lessons of storytelling is you pick the elements that will move a reader, that will lead them somewhere. In my case, I'm trying to get people to care about a crisis in ways that may reduce that crisis, that may bring solutions to it. And so I'm trying to pick the elements that are going to help make a solution, perhaps imperfectly. And I think that's also how I deal with the terror and the fear, that I do find a sense of purpose in what I do. And it's scary. It's incredibly heartbreaking to see some of the things and hear some of the stories. But at the end of the day, it feels like inconsistently, here and there, you can shine a light on problems. And by shining that light, you actually make a difference. And that is really heartening.
We hope you've enjoyed this program and listening to the highlights of this podcast. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast or learn more about environmental projects, click on the subscribe button. Thank you for listening.